Roger Ebert was one of our best-known and most influential movie critics. He and Gene Siskel were the first movie critics to have their own TV show, and his film critiques entertained and educated a large new demographic of moviegoers. Steve James's documentary about Ebert, Life Itself, follows him from his childhood to his post as the youngest movie critic in the country, working for the Chicago Sun-Times, to his television success. The film opens on Friday, July 4th at the Landmark Sunshine and the Film Society of Lincoln Center's Eleanor Bunin Monroe Film Center, and I'm very pleased to welcome Steve James and Roger's widow, Chaz Ebert, to our show today. Hello.
Great to be here.
Hello, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Steve, are you among the filmmakers whose life and career was altered by an Ebert thumbs up?
Just a little bit, and that's an understatement. My first film, Hoop Dreams, Roger and Gene went on their show when the film could only be seen at Sundance, and they praised it and said, this film can only be seen at Sundance, but we really think it deserves wider distribution, and it really launched that film and my career.
Did they help to bring documentaries mainstream?
Absolutely. When you look at the documentaries they reviewed on that show, which was national, over the years, it's an extraordinary list of films.
Did you watch them or read them when you were growing up?
Well, I grew up in Virginia. I discovered Roger when I was in Southern Illinois, actually in film school. I tripped across the show one day back in the late 70s and really fell for it. And so then when I moved to Chicago a few years after that, I started to get the Sun-Times and read Roger regularly.
What about you, Chaz? When did you discover them?
Well, I'm from Chicago, and so their show started on WTTW in Chicago. So I was aware of the show right from the beginning.
Were you a film buff?
It started in 1975. Yes, I was a film buff. That's
because I can't imagine somebody marrying Roger Ebert who wasn't a film buff.
You know, except that we have friends who had spouses who didn't particularly care for films, and they were film critics. So it works better, I think, when you are. And yes, I was. One of the things I was thinking about, Hoop Dreams, I remember how giddy Roger and Gene were when they first saw that film and how important we thought it was to show. And I also remember when Roger saw Roger and Me, Michael Moore's film. That was a documentary he helped sort of propel to a status that documentaries had not achieved before.
Do you think it's possible for someone who's grown up with the internet to understand what kind of major impact Roger Ebert had on film?
The interesting thing is Roger cut across so many demographics. When I go around to film schools or to colleges talking about this movie, people from, 18-year-olds tell me that they know Roger Ebert. That's astounding to me. My husband was 71 when he passed away, and these young kids know him. And you know where they know him? From the internet. Because Roger was an early adopter of technology. He was one of the first film critics to give up his office at a newspaper because he used to carry his computer around. And so,
well, and the show made Roger and Gene a national phenomena in the States.
Yeah, but when did it go off the air?
Well, it went off, with Gene, it went off in 1999, but Roger continued on with Richard Roper. But what I wanted to say is that I think the thing about the internet that's amazing too, besides the intergenerational appeal, is that it made him international as well. I mean, something like
a full 30% of our traffic on the internet is from other countries, and that's why we have far flung correspondents, film critics. We have film critics from Egypt and
everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
When Errol Morris's first really important film came out, there was a newspaper strike, wasn't there, in Chicago? So it wouldn't have gotten any coverage without them.
Errol Morris said he was so worried that no one would ever hear of his movie or see it, and that Gene and Roger got on the air and started talking about it, and they talked about it again, and they talked about it again. They loved that movie, Gates of Heaven.
Yeah, I mean, Earl in the film attributes really the launch of his career to Roger and Gene.
And Martin Scorsese as well.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's really interesting about Scorsese and Roger is that, Roger was the first champion of his very first film, Who's That Knocking? But They were both the same age. They were both Catholic. They were both kind of starting out their careers. Roger's a critic and Marty as a filmmaker. And I think that was part of the bond that formed between them.
You know, can I go back to one thing?
Film, right?
Yes. Can I go back to one thing? Because I do. I don't want to gloss over a question you asked. It's my opinion that Roger is probably the last of the breed that had the type of influence he had as a singular film critic. I do think that even though I know that there are a lot of good people around, the influence and the thing that he brought, and actually he has an international reputation, I don't know if we're going to see that.
Right. A film critic, even at the New York Times, might bring some customers in, but a pan by a Times critic isn't going to hurt a film, for example. But in the past, critics did have more power, and Siskel and Ebert sure had a lot of power.
Yeah.
They created the whole cottage industry of film criticism, really, in this country.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's amazing about that show was the way in which they could truly create a future for very small films. My Dinner with Andre was the first maybe and a perfect example, a film that would have been a phenomena here in New York City, but probably would have gotten out of New York City if not for Siskel and Ebert.
What was Roger's relationship with Werner Herzog? Herzog actually dedicated a film to him, didn't he?
Yes, he did. I think that, you know, with Werner, I think it was because Werner was so passionate about film that when Roger and Werner saw each other, they would talk about it. They wouldn't talk about Werner's films. They would talk about film history. They would talk about films in general, what was good. They didn't only talk about film. They talked about books. They talked about images. What images? Society. You know, Werner, you would say society is really in need of images to stimulate people's imagination. And so Roger would get such a kick out of Werner's passion about that. They talked about everything, but there was still a professional, I want you to know, there was still the professional wall there in their friendship, but they did. They liked each other.
There are concerns sometimes when critics or journalists become too friendly with the people that they cover. Did Roger ever give Werner Herzog a bad review?
I don't know if he gave Werner a bad review.
I think he did.
He gave Scorsese at least one or two.
Yeah, I think he actually gave Werner. I think there was one movie that he didn't, that I can think of, that he didn't particularly care for, but yeah.
But I think Roger took very seriously, like Chaz said, the professionalism of being a critic. I think one of the things he got from befriending some filmmakers and spending time with them was that he really got a window into the way filmmakers think and work and mm-hmm. and the process of filmmaking. And it made him a rather singular critic in this regard, in his understanding of what goes into the actual making of a film.
He did criticize The Color of Money despite his friendship with Scorsese.
Yeah.
Scorsese obviously has forgiven him because he's produced this film, right? But do you think that the fact that the show was first produced on public television gave them more freedom to say whatever they thought?
It absolutely did.
There were no advertising pressures.
Absolutely did. Public television was a gift for them. And that's why after when Disney stopped producing at the movies and Roger made a decision that we were going to produce it, we did for a year, he went back to public television to do it. He had more latitude, and he didn't have to worry about the commercial possibility of the films he talked about. He wanted to talk about all kinds of films, foreign films, independent films.
My guests are Steve James and Chaz Ebert. We're talking about a documentary called Life Itself about Roger Ebert. I know I have to see a lot of movies for this show, and I'm not a film critic. I can't imagine how many films he would see in a typical week. Did you have to go to all the screenings with him, Chaz?
Well, I was the vice president of the Ebert Company for over 20 years. So, yeah, it was part of my job to go to the movies.
So I'll bet you there were some days you said, oh, I really do not want to go see that film.
You know what? Roger and I, even if we thought something was going to be bad, we both loved movies. So, and it was part of the job. So, you know, we just did it.
I could never be a film critic.
Yeah.
Well, one of his unusual traits was that he seemed to love film across genres. He wasn't a film snob. And didn't he once write a screenplay for Russ Meyer?
He wrote the movie Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. He also wrote, Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens. He wrote, but they didn't produce.
He was keeping abreast of the film trends.
They actually had a script for The Breast of God,
really?
Which was never made, but someone would like to maybe do it as a play. And he also wrote Who Killed Bambi for the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, well, I mean, BVD, Beyond the Valley of Dolls, was such a great story in his memoir. It was one of the reasons why we wanted to include it in the movie, because it also shows, like, he was a critic, and then he kind of took a leave of absence to go try writing a screenplay. You know, it's like he had this creative aspect to him that needed to be nurtured, and not just in film criticism, but in other ways.
Well, he wasn't the first. James Agee did something similar.
Yeah.
Wrote some pretty good films. Roger's life in his late years was full of struggle because of his illness. Physical abilities, his appearance were greatly compromised. Did either of you hesitate to give Steve access?
Not for those reasons, no. The only reason that we would have hesitated to give anyone access is we just loved our life, and the thought of having someone follow you around with cameras was really not that appetizing, but having someone like Steve James do it, if we were going to make a film, we wanted a filmmaker who had integrity. And film and Steve James, we knew of, you know, Hoop Dreams, Stevie, The Interrupters, so many of Steve's films. And if anyone was going to do it, he was the one to do it.
He had thyroid cancer originally, but eventually the operations resulted not just in deforming his face, but also in the loss of his voice. Did he ever get depressed? He must have.
Of course he got depressed, but he got depressed when he was going through procedures in the hospital, that when he didn't know what the outcome would be. He was not depressed because of his appearance. He was not depressed. He did miss having his physical voice, and that's when the internet became so important to him. If he didn't have that as an outlet, he said, he probably would have gone insane. So, but he didn't get depressed because he said, it's a good thing I was never a vain man.
Steve, were you at all worried about your viewers not wanting to see him so graphically? Because it's kind of painful to look at him.
Yeah. Well, I remember the first day we filmed.
Can I just ask one thing? Painful to look at him in the movie, not just generally. I mean,
because we knew him when he was younger and more and very vibrant and good looking, and then suddenly he really was deformed.
He was changed. I didn't consider him deformed. I considered him changed, and I considered him beautiful right up to the minute he died.
Well, mostly we see him in the film as gracious, good-natured, and funny.
Yeah.
Well, and what I was going to say is that the first time we went to actually film, he was in the hospital. He'd gone in with this fractured hip. And when I came in the room, he was asleep. And there's no more unguarded moment, I think, for anyone than when they're asleep. And in this case, with Roger asleep, you know, his jaw was hanging down quite low.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard to look at. And I remember in that moment when we first started filming him asleep, thinking, I don't know if people are going to be prepared to see this. But then he woke up, and this moment's in the film. He wakes up, and he looks at the camera, he looks at me, and he smiles. And when he did that, I was actually intensely relieved, because it was like, now it's Roger again.
Mm-hmm.
Chaz, when were you and Roger married?
In 1992, July 18th.
And how long were you together before
he
had cancer?
We were together for 24 years. He had had an occurrence of cancer early on, but he went many years without a recurrence. So,
you, Steve, you called the film Life Itself, which is also the title of his memoir. What did you mean to imply with that title?
Well, I
obviously it works differently than it did with the book.
Well, you know, in a way, I hope it doesn't work differently, because I think that, you know, when you read the book, I remember when I went to read the memoir, I was curious about why he chose that title. And I feel like both in the book and in the film we've made is that I hope that what you kind of take away from it is that for Roger, the great love of his life was life itself. And it manifested itself in so many ways, including Chaz, including movies, including the city of Chicago.
Also, it seems
the title
to me
of the book yeah. came from Studs Terkel. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, the title of the book came from Studs Terkel. After Roger got out of the hospital and he started writing again, Studs would read his work intently and say, and he wrote a letter to Roger saying, "Roger, your writing has never been better about movies, about race, about politics, about life itself." And Roger said, "That's, you know, that's going to be the title of my memoir."
This film is also a love story for journalism that's kind of disappearing. He started writing in college, didn't he?
Well, he started writing in elementary school. He distributed his own little newspaper in the neighborhood.
When he was 8 years old.
Whose idea was it to put Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert together on television?
Some people at WTTW, I think it was Thea Flom, Ray,
I can't remember his last name.
Yes. I'm so
they,
sorry.
I'm sure they put it together because they realized that they were not going to agree on everything. The early episodes of the show are hilarious to watch, if just for the wardrobe, but also they tended to disagree a lot.
Yeah, well, you know what's interesting to me is when you look at that very first show, they're both on their best behavior. You know, they're both like being very courteous to one mm-hmm. another. And it really wasn't until they hit their stride and realized that they actually could express themselves, including the vitriol in the show, that the show really took off.
To see them argue about filming intros to the show or arguing over the merits of one of the Benji movies is a riot.
And they said for the first 6 years, they really barely spoke to each other. They really didn't like each other in the beginning. They were competitive newspaper men. And later they, of course, became very good friends.
Although you have a lot of newspaper men in this film who obviously loved Roger and then admired him and admired the way he approached the story as well as the way he approached his criticism. Chaz, was it hard for you to see the film because it? I'm sure it brings back a lot of very positive memories, but also some very sad ones.
Yeah, in the beginning it was, but I had an epiphany. What a beautiful gift Roger has given to us and that Steve James has given to us to give us this slice of life that so this life lived so fully of a man who was so generous, so smart, who had a big impact on our culture. So and also who showed us how to live with dignity, but how to die with grace and dignity. What a gift.
And it's being opened on July 4th at the Landmark Sunshine and the Film Society of Lincoln Center's Eleanor Bunin Monroe Film Center. My great thanks to Chaz Ebert and Steve James for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.